fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. The coronavirus surge in Wisconsin and throughout the country appears to be declining at last. Mask mandates are disappearing. Performance venues statewide are lifting their vaccination requirements. And Americans are less concerned about contracting COVID-19 than at any point since the pandemic began. But many public health officials say it's too soon to loosen restrictions, and Americans should continue to practice public health measures like social distancing and mask wearing. The mixed messages are enough to leave just about anyone with the sense they're standing on shifting sand. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. As the coronavirus pandemic enters its third year, many people are feeling confused and conflicted, burned out, ready for it all to be just over. It seems as though every time we think we're moving back toward normalcy, there's a new setback. Many experts are predicting the pandemic may be on the way to becoming endemic, meaning COVID cases will typically be less severe, more predictable, and hopefully far less disruptive to daily life. But most public health officials say we're not quite there yet. Today, we'll hear about the latest research on the safety and effectiveness of the COVID-19 vaccines now available, the treatment options that are and are not working to help prevent serious illness and death, and lingering questions that remain. Throughout the program, we invite you to join the conversation. Ask your own questions by calling 800-780-9742. You can email us at route51@wpr.org as well. Dr. Jonathan Tempte is an expert in vaccines and immunization policy and the Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Tempte is chair of the Wisconsin Council on Immunization Practices. In addition to helping craft national vaccine recommendations, he's also led extensive public health research and policy at the community level in Wisconsin. Doctor, welcome back to Route 51. So glad to have you here today.
Well, thank you so much, Shereen, for having me today. It's always a great pleasure to join you and the listeners on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Well, the question on everyone's mind, I'm going to ask right off the bat, when is this going to be over?
That is the most important question out there, and I would be lying to you if I said I had any clue whatsoever. And I think you alluded to this beautifully in your introduction. It's that transition from an epidemic or a pandemic to what we call endemic. And, you know, if we look back a little over 100 years with the great influenza pandemic, there are parts of that genome of that virus that are still in circulation 100 years later on. What we're looking at is SARS-CoV-2, the cause of COVID-19, is going to be with us as a global population from here on out. It's not going to go away. You know, if we look back into the early 2000s when we had the SARS-CoV-1, that first SARS, that erupted into people, spread to about 8 to 10,000 individuals, and disappeared. But this current virus is not like that. It's going to be with us. And so we're going to slowly move from our reaction to what we have now to probably a more muted reaction as we become more and more accustomed to the devastation this virus can cause.
When do scientists and researchers say this is no longer a pandemic, we're in endemic phase? What's the difference?
The best way I can answer that is it doesn't fall easily into the realm of science. There's no hard and fast rule out there. And in reality, this is more for society, for politicians, for artists, for writers, and so on, to have a holistic view. And basically, the transition from pandemic to endemic is when we're comfortable with the outcomes that we see from a virus. So, for example, each year in the United States, we see anywhere from 6,000 to 30,000 or 40,000 deaths from influenza. So far in Wisconsin, I think we've had about 400 hospitalizations, which is very, very low for influenza. But As a clinician, as somebody who's seen patients in practice for almost 30 years, you know, we have our flu season, it goes away and we move on, but we don't have the same level of concern that we would have had, say, in 2009 when we had the last influenza pandemic, or going all the way back to 1918, 1919, when we had this global pandemic that killed perhaps 50 million people.
I want to talk a little bit about the BA2 subvariant that emerged. To many people's surprise, new COVID-19 cases in the U.S. have not begun to rise. Over the past 2 weeks, they've held roughly steady. But this comes with an important caveat, and that is this morning, the CBC in Canada reported that our neighbors to the north are now seeing 100,000 new cases a day. This is their fourth wave, the highest rate since the pandemic began. How concerned should we be about BA2? Are we going to see this here?
Well, the easy question is, or the easy answer is, we are already seeing a lot of it here. And in the upper Midwest, the BA2 variant represents perhaps 60% of the cases we're seeing. So it's already widespread across North America, the United States, Wisconsin, and in my community. The difference is that we had such an incredible outbreak of the Omicron during December and January this year. And so many people came down with that, that they're relatively protected against the BA2 variant. The Omicron family or the Omicron variant contains the BA1 viruses and BA2. And they're relatively closely related. They have similar mutations. And so I think we're benefiting from the damage we incurred 2 months ago in terms of the widespread. The other thing going on is across Wisconsin, about 65% of us have received at least some level of vaccination. And all these things go together to help mute the possible spread of BA2. Now, a couple thoughts. One, BA2 is actually even more transmissible than BA1. And BA1 is really, really transmittable.
Okay.
So it does open the door. And if we look at data from our state of Wisconsin, we actually have seen a slight increase in cases starting about 2 weeks ago. So we're not in that continuous downhill trend that we've seen since January, but we're starting up again. But the good news is it's coming up very, very slowly. But this is why we have to keep our attention out there. We have to keep our eyes open. We have to keep the testing and surveillance systems running so we pick up on these things. And we'll just have to wait and see. But right now, the other good part of the news is across the upper Midwest, it's slowly getting warmer. I woke up to snow this morning, but
yes.
Slowly getting warmer. We're spending more time outdoors and getting away from as much congestion. And that will also help, I think, at least for the next few months.
What do we know about the current vaccine's effectiveness against BA2? You talked a little bit about how many people had had COVID in January, so they've got some of that natural immunity. But what about the vaccines? Are they working against BA2?
The short answer is yes, they're working, but they're not working perfectly. And if we go back in time, the vaccines were formed using the original SARS-CoV-2 virus. So they took some of the genetic material from that virus and used that to create the vaccine. That vaccine works incredibly well for that original virus. But since that time, we've seen an accumulation of somewhere around 60 to 75 mutations in that virus. And as that virus changes and evolves, it also means that it changes to the point where the vaccine doesn't work as well. So, you know, for hard and fast data, what we find is that for Omicron, we still see about a 90-91% protection from hospitalization. And that's about 2 months after receiving a booster. When we get out 4 months, it drops down to 78%, but that's still actually quite good for a vaccine. But the two things that are in play here are variants, and the variants are based on mutations or the evolution of this virus, and the passage of time. And our immune systems are imperfect, and as time goes on, we tend to lose some of that antibody that has been formed to protect us. So we have to keep all these things, you know, in play at the same time and use our best judgment to make recommendations in terms of things like a booster dose.
Well, since we're talking about boosters, there's a lot of confusion about this. There's a lot of debate about it. Last week, the Mercury News raised a question of whether it's possible we might become booster dependent if we get repeated vaccines, that boosters could weaken rather than strengthen our immunity. What is the science telling us about that? Could we be too boosted?
Well, right now, I don't think so. What we see is with a booster dose, for example, the mRNA after two primary doses. What happens when you receive that booster dose is within about a week, your body kicks out a great deal of additional antibody. And in fact, the amount of antibody you see after that booster dose is actually higher than it was after the first two doses. And likewise, when we see a second booster, or basically a fourth dose, we see that same thing happen. What we'll tend to see is over time with additional boosters, you'll probably reach a plateau where the total amount of antibody doesn't go up anymore. But at this point, we haven't seen any decline. Could that happen in the future? Possibly, but we won't know until we get there. And this is why it's so important to have the ongoing science, the ongoing assessments that are being done. And looking at not only the ongoing effectiveness, but the ongoing safety and the ongoing immune responses to vaccines. You know, you often hear it takes a village to raise a child. Well, this is where you need an immense network of researchers, of public health people, of clinicians, people across a wide spectrum, all contributing and collaborating to try and provide the best answers out there for our country and across the globe.
Just briefly, do we think an annual booster is down the road? Are we going to be getting a shot every year?
Well, a couple thoughts there. One, it depends on, do we see changes in this virus? So what are the variants coming out there? Are they significantly different? And with the mRNA vaccines, one of the things that may happen is a relatively easy change in the genetic component in that vaccine, the messenger RNA. And this is very similar to our annual influenza vaccine, where each year the World Health Organization, CDC, get together and determine what are the best components for that vaccine to protect people. So going forward, we have to keep in mind the variants, the waning or the decrease of benefit from the vaccine, and make the best judgment. If I had to guess, I would say it's going to be very, very likely that we would see an annual or an every 2 year booster for this particular vaccine.
Okay.
As time goes on, I think we're going to move into the situation where we're very likely to see this virus becoming seasonal in Wisconsin.
Okay. We need to take a break. You're listening to Dr. Jonathan Temte on Route 51, a discussion on the latest research and information on the COVID-19 pandemic. It's not over yet. Coming up, which treatments are showing promise, which are not, and answer questions about long COVID. When you call us, you can ask your own questions, 800-780-9742. You can email us at route51@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Dr. Jonathan Tempte is with us today as we continue our conversation about the latest coronavirus information as the pandemic enters its third year. What are your questions? You can email us at route51@wpr.org. You can join us by phone as well at 800-780-9742. Last year, there was a lot of discussion about alternative treatments. People were looking for ways to control their infection rates, taking protection by taking medications like ivermectin, hoping that it could provide some protection. What is the research telling us now? Is ivermectin working for some patients?
Well, this is a very recent publication coming out, actually just published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Technically, it was out online before this, but the official publication date is today. But this is looking at roughly 1,300 people in Brazil. It was a randomized controlled trial, which is considered the gold standard of medical practice assessment. And what they found is ivermectin had absolutely no effect on progression of COVID. And looking at outcomes such as hospitalization, these were people who were entered into the trial with early COVID and randomized to receive either ivermectin or not, and it made no difference. And so I think the fair person would say that ivermectin really doesn't have a place in treatment. We just don't see it connotes any benefit. And we do see enough situations where there are people who have actually been harmed by taking ivermectin, particularly when it hasn't been prescribed and they pick it up, for example, at a farm and fleet or something like this, where you might be able to get it for your animals and overdose on it.
I see. Well, what treatments are showing progress? Are we finding some things that are working?
Yes, but that has a caveat. We have two big classes of approaches to treatment directly. And one are the antiviral medications that are provided early on to prevent the reproduction or the replication of this virus. And they tend to work relatively well. And even across into the new variants, Omicron and so on. Some of the other medications are called monoclonal antibodies and convalescent serum, but these are providing people with antibody to the virus. And the challenge with that is the antibodies are very specific for the virus, and if the virus changes too much, they no longer are effective. So recently, in the past week, the FDA has now suspended the authorization for one of the monoclonal antibodies because it's shown not to have much efficacy about or against Omicron. So this is an area that is constantly changing, and clinicians really need to keep on top of this. Now, stepping back, I would argue that most people don't need any treatment for COVID-19. Most people get through this relatively well without treatment. So these are treatments that are reserved more for people who have significant underlying medical conditions or are showing rapid deterioration and look like they're heading toward hospitalization. So those are things that are best, I think, discussed with a care provider and do offer benefit when needed.
I'd like to ask you about COVID tests. What's the difference between the rapid tests that you take at home and the tests that you might get at a hospital or a clinic?
Yeah, the big differentiation is between what we call a polymerase chain reaction, a PCR test, and a rapid antigen detection test or antigen detection test. So the home kits that you might have gotten from the federal government or picked up in a pharmacy are the rapid tests that look for proteins on the surface of the COVID virus. The polymerase chain reactions are looking for the genetic material. And the big difference between the two is the PCR tests will magnify or amplify the genetic material. They use a special reaction that we can take a small amount of genetic material and amplify it by thousands and millions of times. And when you do that, you can become very, very sensitive in picking it up. On the other hand, the rapid antigen tests really depend on the sheer amount of material in your specimen. And what we find is for the rapid tests, they will lose the ability to identify a case if somebody isn't sick enough. So people who are asymptomatic have a fairly low rate of detecting that virus. People who are too early or too late in the infection will be missed as well. On the other hand, the PCR tests are really, really powerful at identifying it, but sometimes what they do is identify the remnant genetic material in somebody after that person has become free from transmission and has recovered. So those are the tests. They both have their places, but one has to be cautious in interpretation. And again, these are things that if there's questions, please talk to your clinician or a public health provider.
So with those home tests, it sounds like there's a level of illness that has to be there, a level of disease that has to be present. But is there a time, some sort of sweet spot where you need to be tested a few days after exposure? What should you do? What's the best guideline?
Well, what we know is after exposure and infection, it takes roughly 3 to 5 days for people to build up the virus in their system. And then one can continue to shed virus for a week to 10 days after that. The sweet spot basically is about 3 to 5 days after becoming exposed through about 5 or 6 days after that. There are some protocols out there that would say that if you have a credible exposure and if you have symptoms and you test and you're negative, if you use that rapid test again 48 hours later, the likelihood of picking up a positive goes up a great deal. So that is one of the things that people can consider using. Again, the PCR tests are really, really good at picking up even low levels of virus. So that's what we consider the gold standard. But many people don't have access to the gold standard. And as federal funding goes away, we're seeing fewer and fewer test centers where people can drive in and become tested. So there really is a place for that home test.
Listeners with questions for our guests can call us at 800-780-9742. You can email questions to us as well at route51@wpr.org. Since we're talking about home testing, I want to ask this. Testing clinics are ramping down. Home testing is up. Is this masking the infection rate in the U.S.? How do we really know how many people are infected when people are testing so much at home?
That's an incredibly important point. When somebody goes in to a testing center and has a test performed, the results are reported to the state for recording and for surveillance purposes. On the other hand, when you do a home test, there is no requirement to report that anywhere. And so as we move toward more and more home testing, we become blinded as to what's actually going on out there. And some companies have tried to come up with methodology to have the tests actually read by an app on the cell phone and then generate a signal that reports. But the vast majority of them do not have that feature. And so I think it's really important for that communication to go on. If people are using home tests, and particularly if we're in a period of time where we think there's not much COVID out there, and they're getting positive, they should really think about, again, being in touch with their clinic or their public health office and reporting that result, just because it's really, really important to track what's going on. Wisconsin has a really, really good system of not only looking at viruses that come in, but doing the full sequencing, which means basically dissecting apart that entire genome or the genetic structure and being able to identify the variants and new variants. And this is a really powerful tool out there for us to make good decisions going forward.
Earlier in the program, we talked a little bit about vaccines, and I would like to circle back to that conversation. When vaccines were rolled out, there was a lot of hesitancy among people who thought it was too soon, we didn't know enough about the side effects, the potential danger. We're more than a year into this now. What do we now know about the safety of COVID vaccines and the potential risk that's there?
Well, I had the privilege of sitting on the CDC's COVID-19 vaccine work group. And for a talk I did just last night, I went back and looked at all the meetings. Since May of 2020, we've had 79 meetings, anywhere from 90 to 180 minutes in length. And so I have had kind of the insider's view to both the safety and effectiveness of this vaccine. I can honestly say, for someone who's worked with vaccines for quite a long time now, that I'm really impressed by the overall safety. The other thing that I'm very impressed with is how seriously the people on our work group, the folks in the Vaccine Safety Office at CDC, take any signal out there. So for example, you may recall early on that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine was discouraged to be used simply because of the rate the occurrence of blood clots. And one of the quotes from one of the safety officers at CDC is, any death due to vaccine is too many. Right now, you've seen that J&J vaccine has gone away. For the most part, there's still some use for that in some individuals. The biggest thing that we're seeing outside of the common side effects, such as my arm hurts or I have a fever, feel fatigued for a day or two. The biggest concern has been for something called myocarditis, which is an inflammation around the heart. We tend to see that more commonly after a second dose of the mRNA vaccines. And when I say we see it more commonly after, we see it very, very rarely, okay? And in fact, we see it more or less commonly after vaccine than after the natural infection. The cases out there, almost all of them have been detected and have fully recovered without any sequelae. And they're detected simply because the word has gotten out that there's a risk out there. But this tends to be a short-lived self-correcting finding that really doesn't lead to much harm. But even with that, there has been openness and transparency out there in terms of this being a risk, information going out to doctors all over the country to watch for this and so on. But again, we're looking at rates in the range of one per 200 to 500,000 doses of vaccine out there. So I think those are the things out there. But the bottom line, compared to almost everything else we do in medical practice, our vaccines are incredibly safe. And in the world of vaccines, the COVID-19 vaccines have been incredibly safe.
There is a new study that examined 14 million medical records that found pregnant women who are vaccinated against COVID-19 are still more than twice as likely to get infected as other vaccinated people. In fact, pregnancy is the highest of the comorbidity factors that the study found, which surprised me. It's even higher than being a recent organ transplant patient. Why do you think that's what we're seeing here?
Well, whenever we are dealing with pregnancy, we're dealing with an altered immune system. So women going through pregnancy have to change their immune system so they don't reject the fetus, okay? And that alteration in the immune system and the additional metabolic demands of pregnancy make somebody more prone to bad outcomes. There was just a recent paper out looking at the effects of pregnancy and the infection being infected or not infected with COVID, and the outcomes were dramatically worse for people who were infected during pregnancy than not. So COVID ends up doing a whole lot of bad things during pregnancy. The good news out there is there have been two recent studies, one from Ontario and one from Norway and Sweden, looking at large, large numbers of individual pregnancies and finding that COVID-19 vaccine during pregnancy has absolutely no negative effect on any of the birth outcomes. So one can be reassured that by being vaccinated during pregnancy, we have protection, even though it's not as good as people who are not pregnant, but still actually very good. And at the same time, it's very, very safe during that pregnancy.
If a pregnant woman is vaccinated or recently boosted, she gives birth, is the newborn protected as well, or does that not translate?
Well, there probably is a little bit of benefit. Let me change focus a little bit. We routinely provide a vaccine called Tdap, that's the tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis vaccine during every pregnancy. You know, the standard is to provide that somewhere between 27 and 36 weeks of pregnancy. And the reason being is that provides antibody to the developing fetus, so the baby is born with antibody that will protect over the first 5 to 6 months of life. And this is really important for whooping cough. Likewise, there does appear to be some transfer of antibody when we immunize women. What we don't know is what the optimal timing is for that. So with Tdap, we tend to use that during that latter part of pregnancy because we know it works so much better than going too early. The guidance right now during a pandemic is anybody, regardless of if they're pregnant or not, should get the vaccine. And we haven't paid attention to the timing of that. So the studies are still being done. But as time goes on, I think we'll see that there is some benefit. The other thing I can mention is all the societies and professional groups dealing with pregnant women, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, American Academy of Family Physicians, and so on, all strongly recommend vaccination for COVID-19 during pregnancy.
You're hearing Dr. Jonathan Tempte, our guest today on Route 51, as we continue our discussion on the coronavirus pandemic and ways to navigate the future now that cases seem to be waning. We'd like to hear from you as well. Join us by calling 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to route51@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Our guest today is Dr. Jonathan Tempte, an expert in vaccines and immunization policy, for a look at the emerging science surrounding COVID-19. What would you like to know? Email us at route51@wpr.org or join us by phone at 800-780-9742. We do have a question from a listener that came via email. This was not signed, but the question is, will the second booster shot have a bad reaction, such as congestive heart failure with the shingles shot, if you would get them too close together?
Well, we have not seen any suggestion of that as of yet. That current guidance is to provide the COVID-19 vaccines with any other vaccine. That being said, the amount of study out there has not been sufficient to look critically at that outcome. So in general, what I suggest for my patients is, during a time like this where the COVID cases appear to be fairly low, that you can afford to spread out the vaccines. The shingles vaccine tends to hit people pretty hard. And many people will report feeling feverish, sluggish, fatigued, muscle aches for a day or two after. And likewise, the mRNA vaccines oftentimes will provide that. So I would suggest, you know, give yourself a break and try and spread these out a little bit. That being said, the guidance is still out there that you can go ahead and provide the vaccines at the same time. And I'll just add in that we are still seeing a few cases of influenza. And if people haven't been vaccinated for influenza, go ahead now at this time. And we do have more data on influenza vaccine and COVID at the same time. And these appear to be very safe together.
And again, the number to call with questions, 800-780-9742 or email route51@wpr.org. I know it's kind of hard to blame people for relaxing a little bit. I mean, it's been a long haul, right? And we know now for most vaccinated and boosted people, a case of COVID-19 is really unlikely to result in severe disease. You mentioned that earlier. But I want to talk a little bit about long COVID, the symptoms that last for months or even a year after a COVID-19 case. Some experts are saying this is real enough. It should worry people, both vaccinated and unvaccinated. What do we know about long COVID?
Well, we know that it appears that it exists. We have really good evidence now that there is an activation of the immune system. And so people who are complaining of long COVID symptoms, when we look at their blood samples critically, we can find several immune chemicals that are at much higher levels or more active than in people who don't have long COVID. And the studies have actually compared people with who were infected and not infected, and people who were infected with long COVID and people without long COVID. And so doing a very good analysis, I think the common denominator is, boy, it appears that there is activation of the immune system. On top of that, we know that people with long COVID tend to have some features in common. If you're diabetic and become infected, you're more likely to develop long COVID. If there's another virus active called Epstein-Barr, that's the virus that causes mononucleosis. If you have the SARS-CoV-2 virus actually detected in your bloodstream. And then finally, if you have an underlying autoimmune disease, or if you have autoantibodies, so for example, with lupus, these are all things that predispose you to long COVID. Now, in terms of long COVID, what we see are kind of three areas. One is the psychological. People with long COVID tend to have more anxiety and depression. And that can be at a fairly high rate. The second is the cognitive, and there can be this ongoing brain fog or difficulty in processing information. And then the third component is more of the physical, the fatigue, the muscle ache, joint ache, and so on. And these things, as you mentioned, can go on for months and months. How long will they go on? We don't know. We're no more than about 2 years into this. But the concern is that many people have this, and we'd say probably about 30% of people who've had COVID will develop kind of the long symptoms. We don't know what to do about those at this time. But we're trying to learn and trying to develop modalities to work with them. Current guidance is more down the line of physical and occupational therapy tools to try and improve function. But the jury's still out on what the best approach is going to be.
I know it's difficult for people with long COVID. They feel, I have a family member who struggles with it, and I have a friend who's struggling with it. And they say they feel like they will never be the same, that their lives have changed. Do vaccines reduce the symptoms of long COVID? Is there anything that they can kind of hold on to?
Well, we do know that vaccines will prevent long COVID through prevention of COVID disease. So the best way to approach long COVID is to prevent the situation that causes long COVID. We don't see a whole lot of benefit for a therapeutic or using a vaccine for someone who has long COVID to make it go away. I think that's a reasonable area of inquiry, but we don't have enough data out there or studies to say one way or another.
We all know people who have taken next to no precautions at all during the pandemic and still didn't catch COVID. How did that happen?
Well, you know, as of today, I think about 24% of Wisconsinites have probably had COVID detected. And if we go beyond that, my guess is it's going to be well over 50% of people who've had it. In my family, in my realm of people that I work with, I would say that 80-90% have not had COVID. My research team, who are involved with sampling individuals, collecting specimens, and so on, we have had about a 20% rate of infection. And the infections in my team have all been community acquired, not, you know, through the workplace or their activity. But so I think it really depends where you are, who you're with, and so on. And so right now, across Wisconsin, flip a coin, you know, your likelihood of being infected is about 50%. Vaccines help. We also know that prior infection will protect you from being reinfected. But part of it's luck. There are some thoughts out there that there are some people who may be genetically less likely to suffer. And across the world, this is really interesting, but there are hypotheses out there that people who are chronically infected with roundworm, for example, will tend to have less COVID disease than people who are not, because being infected by parasites deactivates your immune system in certain ways. So there are a whole lot of things that we will be a whole lot smarter about over the next 5 to 10 years. But this is all really rapidly developing science.
That's so interesting. Can we talk a little bit about animals, pets, and other animals? Can they pass COVID-19 to humans? I'm asking this in part because, of course, many people have pets, but also because there have been recent outbreaks reported in the white-tailed deer population. So does that pose a risk for, say, hunters who consume the meat that they harvest?
The answer, I think, is yes. And there has now been a documented case of spread of COVID from a deer to a human. So we do see that. If we look back over a year ago, in Wisconsin, in our prioritization plan for vaccine, we bumped the 300 people working in mink husbandry up toward the top of the list. And why is that? Because humans can spread COVID-19 to mink really, really effectively, and mink can spread it back. And I don't know if you remember, but there was culling of mink in Denmark. I think 14 million mink were killed because of the threat and the spread. And so the transmission of virus from humans to animals and back to human, and this is called zoonosis, is a real phenomenon. We think that COVID actually got started by movement from bat populations through an intermediate host to humans. And this is something that is, you know, constantly going on in terms of the world. Some animals are more prone than others. And we have found that in Wisconsin, across the Midwest, white-tailed deer are incredibly susceptible to COVID-19. And in fact, many deer herds are highly infected. And if an animal is infected, they certainly could spread it back to a human. So we'll have to look at guidance coming out from the Department of Public Health here and Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources as we move back into the deer hunting season this fall.
So you say that white-tailed deer are incredibly susceptible to this. What about household pets? What's the level there?
Well, we do know that cats and dogs can become infected. Many zoo animals can become infected. And we just haven't not seen a high level of transmission in either direction. But this is a virus that has a connectivity to a very, very common protein or receptor in mammals. And it basically is the the key to the door to get into cells. And once they're in cells, they can reproduce and be transmitted. So I think this is something that we see very, very commonly across many species. And I'll mention very quickly that likewise, we see this with influenza. If you're not aware, across the Midwest, I think there's been about 25 million chickens that have been euthanized because of the highly pathogenic influenza virus. And the reason that's happening is the concern is it's going to spread potentially into people as well. And so we have to always be alert for what's going on, not only in human populations, but in the animal populations and the natural world around us.
Let's talk a little bit about the strains. Right now, the majority of new cases that we're seeing are B2A. This is a subvariant of the Omicron variant. I'm curious about this, though, because like if I get COVID and I ask my doctor what kind do I have, what strain do I have, the answer is probably going to be I don't know. So how do we know? How do researchers identify new strains and know what the dominant variant is?
Well, it starts with collecting a specimen from somebody who has the virus. And that specimen will go to a laboratory, and there are techniques to amplify or increase the amount of genetic material. And then they use a technique called sequencing, where they actually look at the sequence of the RNA, the ribonucleic acid, in that particular virus. And you can map out that virus compared to other strains out there. So when we talk about variants, variants have genetic mutations that are significant enough to cause a different characteristics of that virus. Might make it more transmittable. It might make it less or more harmful and so on. But the variants are classified by the types and the amounts of the mutations going on. My own study, we've been able to show that we have three children actually in a family that had Delta, and then as little as 31 days later, the same children were reinfected with Omicron. And so this is a very, very interesting virus in terms of reinfection, in terms of ability to change. And there's also something called recombination. So in the United Kingdom right now, there are viruses that are Delta Omicron hybrids that they have genes from both mixed together. We have BA1 and BA2 hybrids there. And the science is too early to tell us, does that make a difference? But the potential for recreating new viruses really exists out there and poses kind of a continuing threat that we have to just have a lot of vigilance for.
We have just over a minute left to talk, and I want to ask you, do you have a sense of how this has impacted our overall life expectancy?
Well, this is really interesting. A preprint paper came out just today that I looked at, and between 2019 and 2020, the average American lost 1.9 years of life. And between 2020 and 2021, we lost another 4/10. So overall, Americans on average have lost 2.3 years of life due to the pandemic. That's 3% of our lifespan. And as we're edging up on a million deaths, likely this month or early next month in the United States alone, that really should give us cause just to pause and think about where we are, how we've gotten here, and what we should be doing to come out of this.
Thank you so much. You're listening to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert, once again extending a sincere thanks to our guest, Dr. Jonathan Tempte. Thank you again for being here. Our producers are Joy Ratch-Kramer and Kate Spranger. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Rick is also our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program, as well as our previous programs, at wpr.org/route51. If you have an idea for a future program, email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. Next week, we'll be back with another fascinating discussion, and we hope you'll join us. Until then, we're heading out of town.